Thank you, Martha, and thank you all for inviting me to be here. So when Martha met with me, I think a few months ago, to ask if I would do this, and she told me which chapters I was doing on hospitality, on living simply, I was very happy to get those, because as I sort of thumbed through my catalog of stories in my head, I recognized that I had a lot of stories on those two subjects. But then when I really thought about those stories, I realized that in many instances they were about the opposite of what the Benedictine rules teach about hospitality and living simply. And I thought, oh great. Here's another list that will help me detail how bad a Christian I am. Now, I generally know that I fall short of the Christian ideals, but these Benedictine rules will help me detail exactly how it is that I'm falling short. So, thanks so much, Martha. Yeah, happy to help. Thank you. Thank you, Christine. So, I want to start with the chapter on hospitality and tell a couple of stories from my own life about hospitality. Some of them good instances of hospitality, some of them not so good. So the first one, and this was, the timing of this kind of makes a difference, because it was within, say, a year or two after 9/11. And I happened to be visiting my parents in Ohio, and we got a call, or they'd gotten a call from my ex-brother-in-law, my sister's first husband, and he said, and we were still friendly with him, and he said he was on his way from Oklahoma, where he taught at a college there, and he's on his way to Maryland, and he wanted to know if he could stop in Ohio and spend the night and so on, and he said he had two students with him. And my parents said, oh, that was fine. And then he called that afternoon that he was going to be stopping by, and he called me to say, you know, he was still a few hours out, and he was giving me his estimated time of arrival. And as we were on the phone, he said, what's your mom making for dinner? And I said, it's, you know, chicken or something. And I said, why is that? And he said, oh, well, one of the students with him was from the Middle East, and she was Muslim. And I said, oh, no, it's fine. I said, it's chicken, everything's cool. So I got off the phone, and my mother said, why did Dennis ask you what we were having for dinner? And I explained. I said, well, one of the students with him is Muslim. And she got her back up. Well, in my day, you know, you ate what was put in front of you. I was raised Roman Catholic, and so was she. And she said, you know, if you went to somebody's house on Friday and they weren't serving fish, you just ate what was presented to you. And I said, Mom, you never went to anybody's house that wasn't Roman Catholic. The rest of the night, brother-in-law and his students came, was cringe-worthy. I hate to say that. My parents are lovely people. They really are. My mother's recently passed away, but there were so many sort of awkward parts. My dad went to, you know, do the blessing before the meal, and he made a big point of saying, we're Catholic, and we pray this way before dinner. I was like, oh, Dad, you know, ease up. That's fine. I mean, and the two students, they were lovely and gracious and so on, and they fit in. But, and I had such a hard time with that evening. I was so embarrassed. Now, with some years of hindsight, I realized my mom was afraid, right? What prompted her was, it was post 9/11. I'm convinced she'd never met a Muslim person in her life, or if she had, she didn't know they were Muslim. And so she had just in her mind what the media was saying at that time about Muslims. And later on, she's like, you know, if anybody in our neighborhood finds out about this, they'll come by and they'll throw rocks through our window. I'm like, pretty unlikely, Mom, but I realize now that kind of what was keeping her from being the usual gracious host that she was fear. That's one story. another story that happened to me, I remember coming home one night. This is when I lived in western suburbs of Chicago, and I'd gotten home late at night, and I had stepped out onto my porch to grab the mail out of my mailbox. And it was winter time, as it is most months of the year in Chicago. And I saw a lady walking her dog on the sidewalk, and then all of a sudden I saw her fall. So she had been, you know, hit a patch of ice, strong dog, and she fell, and I heard her cry out. And so I rushed down the driveway, and, you know, she had a bleeding knee and a bleeding elbow and so on. I said, come in, it's cold. And she came into my house, and, you know, I got her kind of cleaned up, and I said, is there someone I can call? And, yeah, she had her son come, I later thought about if I hadn't seen her fall, if I hadn't seen what had happened, and she had just come up and knocked on my door, would I have been as likely to invite her in? I felt comfortable inviting her in because I knew exactly what happened, right? I saw it all, so I wasn't afraid. Another hospitality story. When I was an associate rector, I was in charge of the youth group at my church, and we had gone on one of these walks where you walk as a group and you get sponsors and so on and so forth. Anyway, we're on a 5-mile walk, and a bunch of the kids were like, "Well, can we find some place, you know, to use a bathroom?" And I remember my daughter said to me, "You know, if we change our route just a little bit, we can go by our house and we can let the, you know, the kids use our bathroom." And I was like, "No, can't do that." She's like, "Why?" And I said, "You know, do you remember before we left, we had so much laundry left. I think maybe we'd had a broken washing machine and I got a new washing machine, something. But there were like piles of laundry throughout the house. And it was a really small house. So it was overwhelming." And she was like, "Mom, they're teenagers. They don't care." But what kept me from offering hospitality, I did give in, and they didn't care. I had snacks for them, so they were fine. But I almost refrained from offering that hospitality because I was embarrassed, right? And afraid of having someone think that that's how I kept my house. God forbid. Another story I thought of. Anybody watch Call the Midwife? Yeah. So I'm remembering one of the very earliest seasons. Maybe it was the first one. There's some encounter. There's an elderly lady that the nuns and the midwives they think that she probably has some medical issues, and they want to get close to her and evaluate her, but she won't let them near. She won't let them touch her. And they are trying to offer their services and their hospitality, but she rejects that. And, you know, one of the young midwives is thinking, you know, what's wrong with her? Does she have, mental issues? Why is she so hostile? And going through all of these things, well, what they come to find out is that, like, she hasn't taken off her shoes for years. And her feet and the leather of her shoes had sort of grown together, right? She hadn't had her toenails cut in years, right? And so it was painful. So the idea of having someone touch her, and then there was also sort of some pride issues, but she rejected that gift of hospitality because of fear. There was a time, the only time I've ever run out of gas, I was driving through a neighborhood, not my own, and my car sputtered to a stop, and I'm like, rats. And it was February, and there was a lot of snow, because it's winter most of the time in Chicago, and there was no way that I could walk to where I needed to get gas. There were, I mean, huge piles of snow. You couldn't walk down the sidewalk. So I went up to one of the houses, and I knocked on the door, and this woman kind of took me in. "I'll drive you to the gas station, but we have to wait for my kid's bus, blah, blah, blah." But she just was totally open to me. And I kind of took it in stride at the time, or thought, oh, how lovely that she was so generous. But later on I thought, it's a mark of my privilege that she took me in. I looked like I fit into the neighborhood. I was wearing nice clothes. It was a mostly white neighborhood. I'm white. I was driving a good car. And it made me think about, you know, do we always extend hospitality to those who don't look like us? And how much hospitality do I receive because I don't look threatening, right, in this culture? I also thought about a scene in the book and the movie To Kill a Mockingbird. And early on in the book, the main character, Scout, and her brother, Jem, they invite their friend, a friend from school, Walter, home to eat lunch with them because he doesn't have any food and he doesn't have any money to buy any food. So they invite him in. That invitation, that was hospitality. But then they start eating lunch, and Walter picks up the jar of molasses and starts pouring molasses all over everything on his plate. I don't know if you remember this. And Scout just like, no, that is not what you do. Like, that's for bread or that's for, but she gets very upset and no, you can't do that. And then the housekeeper, Calpurnia, is like, you're out of here and you can eat in the kitchen. And then she lectures her and she says, there's some folks who don't eat like us, she whispered fiercely, but you aren't called on to contradict them at the table when they don't. That boy is your company, and if he wants to eat up the tablecloth, you let him. You hear? Don't matter who they are. Anybody sets foot in this house is your company. But thinking about it from Scout's point of view, I'm guessing she had that fear of difference, not fitting in. And if you remember that book, it's all about what's right and what's wrong, right? And this was just all part of her figuring things out. So as I go through those, what, you know, the word that keeps on coming up for me in all of those stories is fear. So the thing that that I feel like keeps us from doing what we know that we are supposed to do, right? In the Christian tradition, the only religious tradition I know, you know, we have certain stories that we call on that are about hospitality. So Abraham welcoming the three strangers, about the story of Exodus, where the Israelites say over and over, you know, we are meant to be welcoming because we were once strangers in the land of Egypt. Jesus is all about hospitality, about welcoming in anyone. And so as I read this chapter about hospitality, it's not that we don't know what we need to do or why we need to do it, but there are things that keep us from that. And I think it's fear. So then, shifting to the Living Simply chapter. As I was reading the author's words, especially in the beginning, she's talking about that car that she has that she keeps around, and she talks about it's tied up with memories for her. And so, you know, looking at that thing, that possession, I realized that the thing's not the thing, right? And I think that's true with kind of all of the stuff that we buy, anything we buy, that we're buying the coffee cup, the travel coffee cup, but really what we're buying when we buy anything is time, convenience, ease, love, identity, fitting in, security, longevity, like trying to live longer, relief from boredom or pain or sadness. We're buying safety or relief from fear, back to fear. That story in the book about the girl that she encountered in the phone store, and the girl was like, "I want the latest iPhone," and you kind of get the sense of, "Wow, is this a spoiled kid or a privileged kid?" But I'm thinking maybe it's a lot about fear and not fitting in. Sarah and I talked on the way here. She has teenagers, and Sarah was like, "Oh yeah, everything with teenagers is about fitting in." So, yeah, it's the iPhone, and iPhones are kind of cool, but it's really about fitting in. So there are lots of reasons that we buy things, and I don't think it's really about the thing. I think it's about, back to fear of not having enough time, fear of not fitting in, fear of dying, fear of not being secure. There was a time when I was, my family and I vacationed in Traverse City, Michigan a lot. And I remember the summer before I was going to seminary, we were in our usual spot, and we have these different, galleries that we go to in different shops, and there's this one that's sort of all this Northwood stuff. And they had these great blankets. And it, it gets chilly up there, and have I mentioned that Chicago gets cold? And so, there's this blanket. It was just really nice and soft and fuzzy, and I really wanted that blanket. But it was like $40. And I was about to start seminary. I had quit my corporate job, so I had no income. I was going to be living off of cashing in 401k stuff and student loans. And so $40.01 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it really was, and I had lots of internal debate about should I or shouldn't I, should I or shouldn't I. And in retrospect, I realized that it really wasn't about the blanket itself, the thing. I had plenty of blankets, but what I wanted to buy was that feeling of ease, of being able to buy something for $40 without thinking about it. And underneath that was that fear of, oh my gosh, I'm going to live without an income for the next 3 years. And in my denomination, we were told up front, don't be surprised if you don't get a full-time job. Don't be surprised if you don't get any job after you graduate. So there was no guarantees after my 3 years of seminary. So standing there, that blanket, I wanted that because I was afraid. Right? Oh, it's like a blankie, right? You're having your blanket. So, and it's not that I can't handle delayed gratification. I can. The summer before I moved here, I was again traveling in Michigan, and we were visiting wineries, and my siblings and nieces and nephews were all buying the wine that we were trying, and it was wonderful. And I'm like, I shouldn't. Because I'm just about to move, and the movers won't move liquids. And besides the fact, I'm moving to wine country. So why would I? It was easy for me in that case to not buy, to say no to the thing, because I could have, right? I had the means, so it was easy to say no. Another story about the meaning of a thing beyond what the thing is. There's a story that the writer Anne Lamott shared in her blog a few years ago, and it was about orphans and otherwise dislocated kids who survived the ravages of World War II, but who, as they recovered in refugee camps, they had trouble sleeping. Having known for so many years the fear and desperation of hunger, death, loneliness, these kids found it almost impossible to relax long enough to let sleep come. And the adults who were taking care of them were just trying everything they could to soothe the kids. And they finally stumbled on this sort of very simple but really remarkable solution. After they fed the kids their evening meal, they gave each kid a piece of bread to hold. Just to hold. And with that bread in hand, the children were finally comforted enough to sleep. She writes, the bread was a tangible reminder that there was now for them enough to eat, and there would be more tomorrow. There were now people to look out for them and keep them safe. There was now an assurance that life would move forward and that tomorrow would come. So across those two chapters, the hospitality and the living simply, I think there's a common thread. I don't think that we can talk about hospitality without talking about vulnerability and fear. And I don't think that we can talk about living simply without talking about vulnerability and fear. So I was wondering, the references she makes to the different Benedictines about who seem to be really good at hospitality and living simply, and I wondered, are they just much better people than I am? Are they just more resolved? Is it their intention and attentiveness to these things? Or are they operating from some place of security, of being part of a community and having that identity that allows them to feel okay being vulnerable? And on page 135, which is in the Living Simply part, she talks about, the rule is quite emphatic about material possessions. Community members are to share even personal gifts they receive from family or friends. This isn't because St. Benedict was an early communist. In place of private ownership, he offers an alternative. The monastery, the community, will provide for the needs of all. So even though they, I'm sure, don't get flashy, you know, the latest things, they're not toting the latest iPhone. I had a cousin who was a Jesuit, same sort of, you know, community life with no personal possessions. But there's not that. I wonder if being part of that community then kind of takes away that fear of scarcity, right? And that fear of not knowing who you are unless you're defined by your stuff. Two pages later, on 137, she talks about Sister Phyllis, a woman who never had a personal bank account, who owned no possessions but what she held in common with her community, who felt rich enough and secure enough to give away her only coat. I think about, you know, there's that phrase that shows up over and over in the Bible, all over the place. Do not fear, be not afraid. I mean, I think that's a fundamental human thing, and the thing that where I see kind of evil in the world is people trying to play on your fear, right? Which drives us apart. You don't want to give hospitality if you're afraid. You don't want to not buy the thing you want if you're afraid. And so the thing that keeps us apart is fear. And it's really not about how much stuff you have. Last night I was at the showing of a movie at the Marjorie Luke Theater. Julia Louis-Dreyfus was presenting a documentary that she did about her father, who had acquired throughout his lifetime like 3,000 or 4,000 works of art, which are now worth so much money. And he, before he died, he's died in the last couple of years, but he set up a foundation to help out a particular school in Harlem that is trying to look at the systemic roots of poverty and dropout and drugs and gangs in that community. It was a great movie. But afterwards, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her husband, who was the director of the film, there was a little question and answer period. And at some point, the moderator asked her about why she had gotten so kind of choked up in the movie reading a letter from some artist that her father had had a relationship with. And she said, well, Now, remember, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who has big bucks, right? She has all the money that she's going to need. She has a lot of success. She's doing something that she seems to love. They talked about she just got the Mark Twain Prize for sort of lifetime achievement. So she's got it all. But she said she got choked up reading that letter because she felt like her father had a connection, a deeper connection to this artist than he did to her. And she said, I've spent my whole life trying to get his approval. So, fear. So, in talking about how do we live a hospitable life, how do we live a simple life, I think we have to address that fear. And what are the antidotes for that? Of community and connection, conversation, relationship. I don't know what that answer is, but those are some of my thoughts on what that antidote is. And I'm hoping that this community has some wisdom that they can share in the question and answer session as well. Thank you for your time. What happens now, Martha? All right, any thoughts? Stories are good. I'm also a big believer in, I don't think we tell enough stories in our culture.
Even though this one is a little sad, but it ends pretty well. I come from Belgium and from a small village far away from my school. So when I had my finals during high school, I couldn't go home, so I stayed in a convent. And it was poor Sister Claire's, you know. And my aunt, I called her, but she was my dad's cousin, was one of the hospitality people. There were only two nuns that were on the front, and they welcomed all strangers. I mean, it was a real example in hospitality, even though some of them scared her to death. And anyway, years later, so I always felt very safe there. I just loved it. And the nuns were so welcoming. Years later, after I've been here now 40 years, and I go home to visit, my best childhood friend, also remotely, remote relative, and she was the niece of this aunt. I said, well, how is the convent doing? Oh, she said, the bishop sold it right under their feet because they couldn't have enough nuns. I said, well, what happened to our aunt? And she said, well, the mother superior told her she couldn't go to the same convent she was moving to because her furniture wasn't nice enough.
Oh.
And these were poor Sister Claire's.
Yeah.
Okay. And
how bad does your furniture have to be if the poor Claire's don't like your furniture?
She didn't want her to go. She didn't want to make room for her.
Yeah, yeah.
Simply.
Yeah.
Out of fear there wouldn't be enough for her.
Okay.
See? Yep. And then my aunt's sister was now suffering from Alzheimer, and she offered to take care of her. Again, hospitality. But then she died. Now she's alone. And I had never seen such raw fear, because the community that she had based her entire life on didn't exist anymore. And through the family, they finally got her in where the mean mother superior was. But she felt in fear that this woman was going to kick her out of there the whole time. But anyway, Belgium has a good, I call it good socialism. And even though this woman never contributed to the system, because of their hospitality, the government provided for them. And it was enough to cover her, the nursing home, and some extra money. And my cousin hired a lady as a companion who went every day there, and finally she felt at peace again. And she died at peace, but it was a rough road.
A rough road.
Yeah.
So that's my story.
Thank you. Marianne.
This is not really a question, but maybe a comment. And what you said about fear, it's really the root of everything. And I've spent most of my work and my life trying to overcome fear. I'm a psychologist. I also realize that with fear, we constrict. And when we constrict, we shut people out. And we go into our dualistic thinking. It's either or, the enemy, we're good, you're bad. And so I've been spending the last probably 40 years of my life trying to overcome the fear that I grew up with as a child, of separation, not being good enough, all of that coming from the Midwest where there's always winter. Chicago, we... And what I found personally is a practice of contemplation has really helped me to open up, to be present, to allow that fear to bubble up and to look at it in the face and go, I can let it go, I can let it go, I can let it go. So this community is amazing. It's a very contemplative community. I'm very grateful that I've discovered, living in Santa Barbara for almost over 40 years, discovered this community 2 years ago. So you're in the right place. And then I wanted to just add one little caveat, and I don't want to embarrass you.
Oh, help yourself.
I will, because I know you.
I don't embarrass
and
easy.
I go to a church here in Santa Barbara, unnamed. However, a few weeks ago, we heard this wonderful sermon on abundance. Mm-hmm. And abundance is really the opposite of fear. It's letting go of fear and trusting that there will be enough in the midst of maybe nothing. And personally, I've gone through some loss myself and some fear, and I'm really working on trusting. So at the end of this sermon, we were all told to go to the back of the church as we left, and there would be a basket. And in the basket, we were to be gifted with a brand new $2 bill. Mm-hmm. And the rector, who is unnamed, had had actually purchased 300, I think, brand new $2 bills to gift to the congregation or whoever was there that day to go forward in abundance and expand and to share their gift, whether it's to buy a homeless person a cup of coffee or whatever. So I took my $2 bill and I thought about it and I thought about it. What do I do with this $2 bill? It's so precious and important. And I didn't get one that day, actually, because I was in the choir, and we didn't get ours. So I had to go and ask personally and have her dig into her stash. So anyway, I have it on my refrigerator. I decided that's going to be a place where every time I look at that, which I did constantly because I'm always in my refrigerator, I look at that and I realize it's abundance. We live in a world of abundance. There's enough for everybody. And when we let go of our fear, we open our hearts to love. And that's the opposite of fear. So thank you for the $2.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was an Ursuline nun for 20 years, and when I went into the convent in 1954, it was before Vatican II. Mm-hmm. And everything was in Latin, sort of like, and in particular, any possession we had was ad usum, for the use of. This has been an image that I've carried into my 40 years of post-nunness. And I still sometimes put in a book for the use of.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Welcome to Santa Barbara.
Thank you.
Welcome to Infinite Abundance. When people talk about how expensive it is to live here, I said, everything is free. The beach is free. The sun is free. It's the number one weather in the United States. It's all free. And what we need to get is that we live in sheer abundance here. When Rob Lowe moved to town in the 1990s, he sold his $35 million mansion in Smalley. And I asked myself, would you rather live in his mansion in Smalley?
Okay, I get it. Yes, yeah, Smalley. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Or be homeless on the beach in Santa Barbara.
So. Maybe something in between. Yeah.
So high. I just wanted to share a prayer in my unnamed church that we do when we do the offering. And I always love it because it's the God in, what, how is it? God in me blesses and multiplies all that I am, all that I have, and all that I share. And I just, every time, just feel that. So it's not just what you're putting in the plate, but really the source of everything and all that I am, all that I have, and all that I share. And on my checks, I always write, thank you, God, on every check I write. And house cleaning lady, I sometimes give her ahead payments when she has bills coming up. And recently, Tuesday, she goes, you didn't write thank you, God, on it. I always want thank you, God. So anyway, because I recognize that everything comes from God, and that is my source. So I just love that prayer, though, so I thought I'd share it with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. I'm a person who likes words, and I like to connect in my own mind the word Benedictine and or Benedict with the original Latin meaning of benedicere, which is a blessing. And there is a wonderful poem by a fellow named Ken Sehested, who is a stonemason. This is not a monastic poem, but it's a hospitality poem, and it begins, may your home always be too small to hold all your friends. May your heart remain ever supple, fearless, fearless in the face of threat, jubilant in the grip of grace. Isn't that wonderful? May your hands remain open. What a symbol that is. Caressing, never clenched, save to pound the door of all who barter justice to the highest bidder. May your heroes be earthy, dusty-shoed and rumpled, hallowed but unhaloed. I like that, especially as a former Catholic. Guiding you through seasons of tremor and travail, apprentice to the godly art of giggling. Amid haggard news and portentous circumstance, may your hankering be in rhythm with heaven's, whose covenant vows a dusty intersection with our own. When Creator's hope and history rhyme, creation's hope and history rhyme, may hosannas lilt from your lungs, God is not done. God is not yet done. All flesh, I am told, will behold, will surely behold.
Yeah, very nice. And that's a great spot for us to have our break, and we'll regroup. Thank you.